Hello all, welcome to the God Said It Was podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Drakona's Books, which is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially conscious literature, which is a pretty important thing in this day and age, I would say. With me, as always, are the other editors of Kai Drakona's Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. And today we're going to talk about a short novel by Flannery O'Connor, Wiseblood. It was Chris's pick, so I'm going to essentially just hand it over to him. Like, my thoughts about this novel are rudimentary and inchoate. So I'm going to kind of listen to what, you know, you have to say and what you want to think about, Chris, so I can get a better grasp of what I would like to say.
So sure.
Have at it.
I guess just kind of summarizing the book, we follow character Hazel Motes, who is returning from World War II, or has returned from World War II and is basically like on a sort of like a reverse spirit quest. I'd like to kind of maybe get into his motivations for sort of like running away from God, Jesus specifically, being the, he's the son of a preacher, right? He's the son of a preacher who, everyone sort of, when they see him, sort of like thinks that he looks like and acts like a preacher or a man of God, dresses like a preacher. But he is, sort of driven by a kind of very complicated, relationship with, his faith and with his idea of Christ, to start the Church of Christ without Christ. And the church is a pretty loose term. He basically just drives around and preaches on the street. He encounters a lot of very strange people. It's really a funny, like, just over the top strange book. Mostly, I don't think these people, like, these people all seem like very crazy.
They're cartoons,
that's the word, thank you.
They're not, like, one thing about O'Connor's fiction is, for being somebody who, you know, like, we all did an MFA and we encountered O'Connor a decent amount. She's very revered in that setting, but she doesn't really do people that feel like real people, you know? To me, at least, it's never felt like that. And it's particularly true in this novel, and maybe a bit less true in some of the later short stories, but, I mean, Good Country People, those aren't real people. They're jokes, you know? And I mean, people... You know, she led a very sheltered life and died young, and you hear people say things sometimes, and maybe I'm strawmanning here, you know, but you hear people say sometimes things that basically amount to, like, wow, it's amazing that somebody with so little real world experience could, like, capture such psychological complexity. But it's always seemed to me like she doesn't really, and that's not necessarily a knock on her, right? It's just her characters to me always feel much more like weird ideas and jokes than like anything that kind of has any resonance with how people really are in the world, you know?
Is that, and that was something I was kind of wondering about, Hans, and maybe this is an avenue to talk about it, because I'm having a hard time describing what happens. You know, basically Hazel Motes encounters several other people who are on, like, I guess, like, their own version of, like, different quests. Hawks, the blind, or the fake blind preacher, who is sort of successfully at least making money off of posturing as a man of God, which is something that Hazel Motes is definitely not interested in. Hazel Motes is interested in the truth, which is actually driving him contrary to the sort of, like, you know, I guess there's also the Hoover Schoetz, the other street preacher, former radio personality, who tries to use Hazel Motes's, you know, preaching style to sort of like make money. So Hazel feels like one, like, person, one seeker of truth in a mostly a very, like, selfish, batty, petty, cartoony cast of characters. And it's hard to just, I don't know exactly, like, he basically, the things that happen to him feel sort of, I never read Hunter S. Thompson. I've only seen Hunter S. Thompson movie, like the movies based off of the things that he's written. And it just feels like these fragmented moments, you know, these fragmented scenes, and you know, he tries several times to sort of like start over, and at one point drives away and is pulled over by a policeman who just pushes his car over a cliff for basically no reason other than Hazel says he doesn't have a driver's license, and then the policeman just drives away, and it just feels very all over the place. And I guess, like, that was one thing that I was wondering about, was, is this kind of like a writing style of the time? Is this sort of,
I don't think it's a writing style of the time necessarily. I mean, it's, there's a technique that she uses where, and maybe there are exceptions to this I'm not thinking of, so correct me if this seems inaccurate. She is very, there's very little interiority in her narration, right? We see people do things, we see people say things, and for the most part, we don't have any particular examination of really what they're thinking at the time that they do it. Or if we do have that examination, it's not particularly revealing, right? I mean, like, I don't think we've mentioned yet the character of Enoch Emery, but he's maybe the most absurd and irrational of the lot of them, right? And he, I mean, what does he do? He steals a mummy. He breaks into a museum and steals a mummy, gives it to Hazel Motes, steals a gorilla costume, scares some people in a park, and then that's his arc, right? And we do have a great deal of interiority in him, but the interiority in him is basically just him thinking, I'm going to do something and I don't know what it will be or why, right? And I mean, he says that he has wise blood and he, like, learns things from his wise blood, but in fact he has bonkers blood, right?
Yeah, or he's open, he's resisting internally his compulsions, but then can't help himself. And so,
if anything,
because his internality doesn't match up with in any way with what he's doing.
If anything, I think all his internality serves to do is show the irrationality. All his internality serves to do is show how little even he understands why he's doing what he's doing, right? And I mean, I think that this is a very enigmatic novel, partly because none of what the characters do makes sense, and partly because there's no attempt to really give us an explanation for why it makes sense, right? And I mean, I guess there are hints of explanation, right? One imagines there must be some relationship between what Hazel does and probably both his experiences in the war and also his the fact that he comes back from the war and discovers that his childhood home is derelict and his whole town no longer exists, right? He goes to war, he sustains some kind of, you know, damage that's not visible, but that's bad enough that he gets a nice disability check, as we learn at the end. And then he comes home and home is gone, right? And it's reasonable that that would drive somebody kind of nuts, right? That maybe that would make somebody angry at God, right? But that framework is so subtly established that if you're not paying careful attention to it, he can seem just kind of irrational. And I don't know that, I mean, even if you have that background to like kind of understand where he comes from, it's still kind of hard to kind of really know why he does what he does, but it's some clue at least, isn't it?
I think that as like something that incites him to be, to incites him to like reject God and to go on this. I mean, what it feels like a spirit. It feels like he's an inherently spiritual person who is rejecting spirituality, and that sort of contradiction, I feel like, is supposed to illuminate a kind of honesty in his spirituality that is not present in the people around him. It's something that he can't help. Is that a misreading that, like, even though he is very, and it's really funny in the moment, like it's really funny it's a funny book in the moment, like line by line, it's funny, and it's compelling. Excuse me. It's compelling how he seems to reject Hoover Schotes. He's rejecting Hoover Schotes' attempt to like help them both make money off of, you know, well, he's not really that popular. He never gets that popular. People don't like what he has to say. People like what other people have, you know, other preachers. People like what, you know, the blind preacher is doing. People like what Hoover Schotes is doing. People don't like what Hazel Motes is doing. And Hazel is not trying to make money off of them. He's trying to tell them that, like, there is no salvation through Christ. And even though he's doing that, even though he's kind of preaching a, is it existentialism, or what would you call it? He's preaching a, you know, a very,
it's a very unformed kind of proto-atheism, I suppose.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an atheism that really has nothing to it other than just an inversion of the basic tenets of Christianity. He doesn't have any kind of philosophical framework to move beyond that, right? So he has nowhere to go beyond, actually, you're not redeemed. Actually, there is no Jesus, right? He's the original like annoying college atheist, except he doesn't even have like
no, yeah.
You know, he doesn't even have Camus or something to establish an alternate kind of framework.
Yeah. We see that happen because he latches onto a phrase, redemption through blasphemy, and then he later recants that and says even blasphemy is just a way, and there is no way. So he's basically deconstructing faith, you know, and saying anything that is structural is wrong, and what he wants is truth, and that manifests ultimately in him blinding himself at the end, and then physically he causes himself pain. Like he's becoming a little bit of a you know, self-flagellating.
Flagellant.
Yeah. He ties barbed wire around his chest. He fills his shoes with stones and glass. And he is ultimately, even though he's rejecting the traditional means of connecting with a higher power, with any higher power, this doggedness on his part is a kind of a quest, is a kind of a spiritual journey. And we're at the end, we're kind of internal to his landlord, who's sort of mystified by him, And sort of like the landlord, I guess we're just not able to follow him. Like we don't get to see what is going on in his head in the last part of the novel where he is blind, he is punishing himself, he is possessive of some kind of magnetism that he didn't seem to have before, and we don't know what's going on inside of his head. Other than that, he's maybe transitioned in some way. He's changed in some way. And then he dies.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he, it seems like he, his fundamental issue, and I don't know if O'Connor would agree with this necessarily, but it seems to me like his problem is that he wants to reject faith. He wants to reject evangelical Christianity, but he has no framework to do that with other than the kind of symbols and signs and processes of evangelical Christianity, right? So he ends up, he's obsessed throughout with the question of salvation, cleanliness, redemption, but he can't let go of that particular idea, and he can't really find any way to achieve that other than through, because Jesus didn't take the punishment he deserves, right? Because Jesus doesn't exist to redeem him through being punished. He has to infinitely punish himself in the absence of Jesus redemptively accepting the punishment of the crucifixion. So he basically flagellates himself to death. Is that, I mean, that's pretty much, I don't know. Do you think that's an accurate reading?
I didn't necessarily understand his motivations to the extent you did.
I'm not saying I
That.
understood him. I'm just trying to draw up a workable theory, you know?
Okay, yeah.
That's not, I mean, I didn't, you know, I know sometimes I'll go look up critical material. I didn't in this case, right? So, I don't know that I'm reading it right when I say what I just said.
I'm trying to remember what causes him to blind himself. Is it when he discovers the
It's when
when
he's
the
not able to
mummy.
go.
Oh,
It's
yeah,
when
when he
he's not
tries to
able to
drive away.
go to the other city, right? He tries to go to another city to preach. He's unable to. There's a line there. I don't remember it exactly, but even while he's driving the car before the cop pushes the car into off the cliff or whatever, there's a line he says where he kind of realizes that there isn't any other city. That the idea that there are other places is kind of an illusion, right? And that revelation seems key to me. That he's running, it's like he wants to go to another city, maybe partly because he's running from something, and he comes to understand that he can't, and at that point has to, I guess, blind himself to prove that there is no God, right? To because the Asa Hawks, the preacher, was going to blind himself to prove that he believed in God and then chickened out at the last minute. So by blinding himself to prove there is no God, he proves that his anti-faith is stronger than Asa Hawks's conventional faith. I don't know. I mean, that's one way to read the motivation for that. I don't know if that's correct. Maybe there is no correct answer.
Yeah, I feel like there's probably little clues, or thoughts or fragment things that you could read as clues. I'm thinking of he, I'm thinking of the landlady is her desire to take advantage of Hazel seems to evolve, seems to grow, into something genuine, a genuine desire to connect with him because of how compelling he is, and a combination of how compelling he is, how lonely she is, and basically how meaningless and awful this world is. That especially, 2020 is bad, but I honestly think that, this world in Wiseblood is hell. It's pure hell. These everyone is so selfish and so petty, and the landlady, you know, tries to get him engaged in life, in things around him, to draw him out of this like inward space that he seems to have receded into, his you know, aided by his blindness, and I assume the pain that he seems to inflict on himself constantly, and he says that he's too busy, and there's not enough time, and I don't know necessarily what that means. I do know that, like, the most consistent texture, meaningful texture to me, like the real kind of like thing that I cared about in the end, was the landlady's arc, more than, even though it's just a tiny piece of the book, her own like shift from being, you know, just interested in Hazel Notes' money, trying to seduce him, trying to get him to marry her just so that she could continue to, you know, take in his money, or be more efficient in taking his money. Like, she raises the rent on him when she learns that he has this money coming from the government for his injury in the war. I was moved by her, and I wasn't moved by anyone else.
That's an interesting point, actually. Do you think that she's maybe the one character that does achieve some kind of redemption, if in some very limited way?
She's the only one. Hazel, it feels like, I don't know, it feels like we are not allowed to see, because of, Hazel has set an impossible standard for his own, like, for what truth can be, which is basically something that has to live outside of any structure, any meaning, you know, any like established paths or symbols, or, you know, doctrines that lead to redemption. And that just means that, like, I just feel like, you know, that's the void. Like, he has to, like, everything that he has to go through in the end is something that we can't follow him on. That's what I understood. I've only read it once. You've read it twice, and then the landlady is just kind of a perspective on that, like. She was the most, hers was the most intelligible, human, meaningful arc. So maybe that answers your question for me.
Yeah, I've been, while you were talking just now, I was going through and trying to reread or just glance over the landlady's internal monologue at the end, because I didn't have a real clear sense of whether she was compassionate or foolish or cynical in the guise of, you know, if she was being cynical and selling it to herself as compassion, or if she was truly compassionate. And to be compassionate for Hazel, is that admirable or is that foolish? I don't know. Patrick, you made a thinking sound. I don't know if you had something you wanted to pitch in.
I don't want to derail the conversation, so I want you two to, like, you know, finish up this part, because my thoughts in this novel have been very different than what either of you have been talking about. So I don't know, maybe you guys want to, like, keep going with that until it, like, it, you know, works itself out, and then we can maybe talk about my reaction in a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, so I having glanced back over some of the landlady's thoughts, it does seem like It seems like she... Well, let's see. So the last bit of internal monologue that we have from her is something like, she had had a hard life without pain and without pleasure, and she thought that now she was coming to the last part of it. She deserved a friend. If she was going to be blind when she was dead, who better to guide her than a blind man? Who better to lead the blind than the blind, who knew what it was like? So it does seem to me like, I mean, that's not the worst thing somebody could think, right? But there is kind of a fundamental selfishness to it, right? Even in her kind of, even in the last moments, she's framing him as something she deserves somehow, you know, as something to win for herself as a way of seeing and thinking in the world. Maybe that's being unkind to her. I don't know. But I have to admit that I'm not convinced that she ends up having a redemptive arc. I think that her relationship to him is complex and complexly experienced, but I'm not convinced that it's ultimately redemptive or that there's any goodness she has that would distinguish her from the other characters. But I might be wrong about that. I don't know. Maybe I'm not giving her enough credit.
Moving. I'm reading the final, because we end with her and observing him. And I guess like this could be read either way, sort of like she is on the other side of something from Hazel and is only reacting to, because she's drawn up as much as, you know, a character is a character in this novel, as someone who basically just hates what she can't have. And that makes it hard. She's kind of, it's hard to disentangle that real kind of awful characteristic from anything that would be genuine, that would drive her to genuinely desire to be with somebody, you know, like to kind of actually like give to that person. And I don't know if there's evidence. I think that it's hard to find evidence of her wanting to give to Hazel rather than simply to take. But she is with Hazel at the end. Hazel's dead. She leaned closer and closer to his face, looking deep into his eyes, trying to see how she had been cheated or what had cheated her, but she couldn't see anything. She shut her eyes and saw the pinpoint of light, but so far away that she could not hold it steady in her mind. She felt as if she were blocked at the entrance of something. She sat staring with her eyes shut into his eyes and felt as if she had finally got to the beginning of something she couldn't begin. And she saw him moving farther and farther away, farther and farther into the darkness until he was the pinpoint of light. And maybe I'm reading too much into her. I do feel, I did feel moved by her internal conflict. Like, I guess, and maybe it's just because her internal conflict, you know, next to the other internal conflicts in this book, like Enoch is debating in his mind whether, Enoch is moved by his hatred for animals and his just constant confusion about the world around him. And I felt drawn to her, and something in her conflict in her story felt like we tracked enough of a kind of an I don't know, an authentic person. I don't know where to take that. Patrick, you had thoughts, man.
Yeah. I just, like, It just didn't. It seemed way more straightforward than you guys are making it out to be to me. I mean, you know, but then again, you know, I tend to read very literally. But I was thinking a lot about A Good Man Is Hard to Find when I listened to this and was comparing it, and to me it. I don't know. It feels like it's all pretty straightforward, and this is, you know, a critique of non-belief and a critique of what kind of, I would say it struck me as like a critique of like a straw man of atheism, is what it seemed like to me. And from, I did read some interviews with Flannery O'Connor on this subject and on this story, because I was feeling like I didn't, like I had these rudimentary reactions to it, like this seems pretty straightforward, this seems like just not a very good critique of atheism to me. And
yeah, I was going to say it's almost comically bad as a critique of atheism.
Right.
It's I think maybe I resisted that reading because if that's the standard we're approaching it as, it's kind of terrible.
Right, exactly. And like I don't think it's like bad on the sentence level. I actually think it's pretty compelling on the sentence level. Like she kind of has these nice rhythmic sentences that are actually pretty pleasant to listen to, or read, I imagine. But like thematically, it seems like a bad critique of atheism, and like that's what A Good Man Is Hard to Find struck me as too, like a bad critique or a dogmatic critique of, you know, not living a perfect Christian life. And so to my mind, like, she's kind of setting up this character who's an atheist, Hazel, as a way to critique his beliefs. And in I was going to say, in one of these interviews I read, O'Connor said that Wiseblood is about the inevitability of belief. And I thought that was pretty interesting, like, you know, if she believes that belief is inevitable, then, you know, like Hazel's just a dude caught in bad faith. Like I'm going to believe, but I don't want to believe in Jesus. Like, I refuse to believe that there's a God. So I'm going to believe in this like weird hollow atheism. And like at the end we were talking about Mrs. Flood, and like she has this arc where she just wants to use him, but then she falls in love with him. And Chris, you said maybe it's redemptive. Hans, you said you didn't think it was. And I think I side with you, Hans. Like, she at the end, like, maybe she's come to love him. And she has this weird delusion that Hazel's corpse is alive, and that resonated with the O'Connor quote, you know, that belief is inevitable, but again, it's this kind of bad faith kind of belief. It's not, you know, it's a belief in a falsehood. So I don't know, that was my reaction. My like, I remember during our podcast episode on Gilead, Hans, you said initially you thought any fiction by a Christian person would just have to be bad. But then Gilead changed your mind, and you know, Gilead is a good novel. And I have to bring up, you know, I have to bring up Steinbeck too. Like, he's very clearly a Christian, And even if like the East of Eden allegory is a little too much, like it's still not dogmatic. And to be honest, I think O'Connor is dogmatic.
Can I admit something here?
Yeah, yeah.
So, boy, and I don't know what direction this will take this episode in, but like, I realized reading this novel, and I don't want to seem like I'm complaining, right, about your choice, Chris. Like,
go ahead.
This is a very, like, at a line level, like you guys have mentioned, this is very witty and in some ways compelling. And she has this way. I mean, there's a trick that she has to do where, because of a certain kind of propriety that she has, and because of the lack of interiority, there's a way that she kind of talks around what's happening sometimes that calls on her to be very witty in her narration. And some of the spoken dialogue is very witty, right? So I appreciate that about this novel. I recognize the ways in which what she's done with the form of the short story were very foundational for a lot of literary short fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Those two caveats aside, I realized reading this, I don't think I like Flannery O'Connor very much.
Oh, man, I don't.
I don't think I like her fiction, and I think whatever sense I get of her as a person is negative from her fiction, right? And I know that, like, she has books of letters that people appreciate, and I mean, I a couple months before we read this, I had read this article in the New Yorker about what a nasty racist she was, right?
And I read that one too. Like,
and I
don't actually think
I bring that up partly to say that, like, I don't think even though, like, it's not a flattering article, I don't think that it actually. I think I would have come to that conclusion reading this, even if I hadn't read that New Yorker article, right? Because the question of race is mostly pretty peripheral to this book, but it's just like, I don't know, like, she's, her characters are all these inhuman cartoons. There's no warmth or compassion to how she thinks about people at all. And, you know, she has, like, all her stories and her novels are just these, like, ridiculous cartoonish people being put through a series of, putting themselves through a series of terrible events and then dying, right? Like, I mean, I know that I'm exaggerating to some extent here, but she's, of all the, like, notable canonical literary writers, it's hard for me to think of another one with less humanity in her work. And whose less humanity in her work and less thematic, like, when you can make out a theme, it's generally a bullshit theme.
I did enjoy
reading this novel, and I'm glad that I have a better understanding of it, because I'd completely forgotten it after my first reading. But anyway, I don't know. Feel free to defend either one of you. But
I won't defend. I think.
Go ahead,
Patrick.
No. I was just going to say that I think I wouldn't defend, that I'm probably on your side, Hans. Go on, Chris.
I didn't get the anti-atheist. Theme. I didn't get that from this, because I actually found Hazel's structureless, like, sort of desire, his structureless, like, attempt at you know, something atheistic, you know, was compelling to me, even though it was sad as, like, an attempt to create something, you know, outside of Christianity, something that wasn't, you know, driven by, like, traditional doctrine. It was compelling to me for the effort, even though it didn't coalesce into anything meaningful in the end. It was just, even though he was constantly, you know, fumbling, and it wasn't impressive to the people around him. I actually liked, I didn't get that, you know, I got that he, I guess, like, I now that you're, now that I'm saying this out loud, like, you could say that, like, if she believes that belief is inevitable, then you create that vacuum where belief used to be, and it is an unnatural state, and then you kind of are constantly, you know, you struggle to maintain that, and he struggles to maintain that. I kind of, I don't know, that didn't bother me as much. I didn't find that to be like in a. I do kind. I mean, like, I mean,
So,
isn't that kind of.
just so I understand, so you're saying in a way you find Hazel, worthwhile or remarkable or noteworthy insofar as he struggles to maintain his disbelief or his,
I do think that there's actually, I think you're right, Chris, that there's something that does feel authentic about that, right? Like the details of how it's presented and how it occurs are so outlandish that it's hard to, you know, they're kind of outlandish and reductive. But I mean, I've known people who were, you know, like I've never been that religious, and so I don't have to work that hard at not being not believing in God, right? I find it very easy to not believe in God. It's not something I have to remind myself to do. But like I've known people who were raised in like the most like, you know, like the people I know that put the most effort into, you know, listening to Sam Harris podcasts and like continually maintaining an intellectual framework for not believing in God tend to be people who came from very religious households, right? There's You can't just, it's much harder to just kind of let go of it than to kind of embrace a mirror version of it. And I mean, the mirror, you know, like the whole infrastructure of like, you know, you read Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, and you know, you watch YouTube videos about, you know, here's the 10 millionth reason evolution actually did happen. Like that process is. There's a much better framework to do that in than is available to Hazel Motes, right? I mean, his problem is he comes from like such a intellectually, culturally benighted world that he doesn't have even a 10 millionth of that. So I think that struggle as he experiences it, I think does actually have a certain plausibility, right? I think the way that O'Connor frames it, there's a kind of a conscious, there's like a condescension in it that like, I dislike, you know, but
I see that.
But it's
I
reasonable.
hear
It's
that now.
reasonable.
Yeah. No, I and hearing you guys talk about it, like I think it is. I enjoyed this book, and I was compelled by Hazel Motes, and I think that I think I find myself to be more. I'm more agnostic than you guys. Like I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool atheist. Like I don't find the conceit that Flannery O'Connor is writing from to be, you know, off-putting. I think that you can read this, though, as, you know, compelling on one at on in one dimension and then very shallow in almost every other dimension. And I concede that. I think that gosh, I'm trying to kind of like mount a defense for Flannery O'Connor, at least not her character, but you know, in the literary canon. And it is true. Her characters are flash in the pan and not really much else.
Yeah, and I wish a little bit that we had someone here with more of a grounding in her work who could maybe argue that. Who could argue against that more persuasively? I have read her complete short stories, but the ones, I mean, it was years ago, and most of them I have a fairly hazy recollection of. Other than, you know, we've mentioned Good Country People and Good Man is Hard to Find, and those, in some ways, I think are, they're not emblematic, right? Because they are more outrageous than some of the other, especially the later work. And my memory of the later work is that it did have somewhat more texture to it, but it still had this kind of meanness that, I don't know, like the, there's, I can't remember the name of it, but she has this short story. There's this guy, he's, it's narrated from the perspective of a grandfather, and he has a granddaughter who's maybe 6 or 7, something like that. And she's this very like spunky, intelligent, cool, you know, girl. And the grandfather basically, like, you know, like to each of them kind of thinks like, you're the only person in the world who's not an idiot, right? And they're kind of right. Like, and then they have a fight, and then she like climbs up on a rock and falls off and hits her head and dies, and he's crushed. And that's the end of the story, right? Like, and I don't know, man. I think I've maybe I've mentioned this in maybe this was in a conversation with somebody else, but I don't have any problem with like fictional stories in film or in, you know, TV or whatever. I don't have any problem with them being sad if it's like authentic, earned sadness that means something, right? And I just remember thinking like, this doesn't seem like authentic, thematically important darkness and sadness. This just seems like a reflex of somebody that, you know, it just seems reflexive and like manipulative, right? And again, you know, maybe if somebody were here who were more familiar with her work and more
maybe that's why people like her.
Maybe
there
so,
are,
you know,
maybe there are a ton of sadists in this world and they're just like, yeah.
Well, and I mean, maybe that's why, you know, one thing that we've just touched on in passing, like in our conversation before this, is like this novel in particular seems to be very beloved of musicians, right? Like there's the Corrosion of Conformity album, there's the singer who calls herself Wise Blood, who was a former evangelical Christian, so it seems like maybe the novel spoke to someone who did go through that same process as Hazel Notes. Maybe that's to its credit. There's the Nick Cave line that I quoted, but like, man, Nick Cave as a writer has so much more like emotional balance and depth and compassion and warmth than Flannery O'Connor, right? Like, even as a songwriter, has all those, you know, much more than her fiction does, to me at least. I don't know. So it, but I mean, it does seem to me like musicians tend to be like, if you look at the literature and fiction that musicians like, for whatever reason, like the stuff that ends up really influencing rock music, or tends to kind of have, it tends to be the most kind of like over the top dark stuff, right? And so maybe the nastiness does speak to people. Or something about the mixture between like her kind of propriety and shelteredness, and then the nastiness of the world that she creates, you know. This is extra textual, but have either of you guys ever seen the film?
Not me.
I didn't know there was one.
Yeah, it was directed by John Huston. It came out in 1979. I watched it a couple days ago, and I actually, in spite of not liking this novel very much, I actually really enjoyed the film. I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, like I should say, it's remarkably faithful to the novel. The film is, the plot is exactly the same. The sequence of events is pretty much identical. A lot of the dialogue is the same. There's not really any significant dialogue added that I could tell, right? Like it's about as faithful an adaptation as I can imagine anyone making. But there's something that happens, I think, when you have a really compelling actor.
Yeah, Brad Dourif.
Awesome. Yeah, Brad Dourif plays Hazel Motes. He's fantastic. In everything he does, he's fantastic.
Yeah, he really is great at everything.
And the old blind preacher is played by Harry Dean Stanton.
Oh, shit. Yeah. He would be great.
And we haven't talked about her at all, but Sabbath Hawks, the daughter, she's played by somebody named Amy Wright, who was in The Deer Hunter, who is not at all well known, but is fantastic and actually very appealing in the role.
Mm.
And there's something that happens, I think, where like when you have a really good actor portraying these kinds of irrational actions and strange motiveless things. Like it lends, like, a really good actor, I think, can take something like that and just through their presence as a human being lend it a sense of depth and richness that maybe it wouldn't have on the page, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, Hazel Motes just in my head is much less compelling than Hazel Motes as embodied by Brad Dourif, right?
I mean, to a lesser extent, I think audiobooks kind of have some of the same benefits as film, you know, in that there's someone performing and adding gravity and Bronson Pinchot actually did the Wise Blood audiobook that I listened to, and he was the same guy who did Zeroville, and he's by far the best audiobook performer that I've listened to. He's just phenomenal.
It's awesome to listen to. Why is the scene with because I think it's the same guy. Do you have Audible, Patrick?
Yeah, I have Audible.
It was free on Audible for me.
Yeah, it was free on me. There's some number of titles that they just let you listen to for free.
The scene with the was she a Shake Shack lady? The one that is sort of manly that Enoch teases and she lashes out at them and Hazel insists that he's clean. It had me.
Right. Was that? I'm laughing.
Oh no! It had me just cracking up.
Yeah, I know.
It was. I was laughing out loud. I was like shoveling snow and stuff, and it was awesome. Maybe that colors my impression because I did enjoy listening to this book.
Well,
so much.
Pinchot. I don't know what it is about him, but he's a fantastic audiobook performer, and he does voices really well. So, anyway.
Yeah, so, I'd recommend it. Anyway.
So it looks like, you know, our conversation has kind of reached an end point. So what's up, Hans? What are we going to do next?
So my pick for the next book, and I have not read this. I don't yet own a copy of it. I'm going to try to take care of that this afternoon. But I want to read Homeland Elegies by Ayad Akhtar. Homeland Elegies, yeah.
Okay, let's look this up and see what it's all about.
It's a novel about... I read a profile of Akhtar in The New Yorker. And it's my... The thing that I came away with from the profile was that he does a very... He's known for doing a very... For, like, capturing American Muslim life in a very textured sort of way, right? That kind of trying to capture the complexities of it in a relatively clear-eyed, unsentimental way. And I thought that would be interesting, and I'm curious to see. Apparently blends fictional techniques and somewhat autobiographical things in kind of interesting ways. So,
I try to...
Every now and again, I'll try to, you know, have us read something relatively new just because I feel like, you know, there's an effect with literature where something about the nature of the form, people are much more, you know, when I was a fiction writer, I was always kind of aware of like how much people prioritize old things, essentially, right? Mm. It's not like, you know, if you're going to be a musician, you're not constantly having to fight people's urge to listen to Glenn Miller, right? But if you're going to be a novelist, you have to fight the fact that a lot of people, if they want to read something they regard as fine fiction, are going to instinctively go to something from, you know, 80 years ago.
Right.
So I thought, well, this is a new thing that it'd be interesting to read and talk about. So
it looks pretty interesting. Ayad Akhtar. Cool. All right. You heard it, everyone. We are going to talk about Homeland Elegies by Ayad Akhtar next time. Looks like a interesting novel about a Muslim family at, you know, dealing with the aftermath of 9/11. So that should be pretty interesting. Otherwise, I hope you enjoyed this particular podcast on Flannery O'Connor's Wiseblood, and peace out until next time, comrades.